wiggling to avoid. Okay, they're just a reflective wiggle room. All right. Keep going.
As opposed to like original meaning, what the text meant when the bill was signed at the time of date, or the founders meant it to ordinary, regular meaning, what it means today.
Okay. Basically, a meaning inherent in the text of the statute. Not what people thought when they wrote it in 1790, not necessarily what an ordinary meaning might be to a man on the street, because it may be a tax statute, and who knows what the hell your actual net income is for IRS purposes. Okay? Sheet for you. I'm not sure how many of you have seen this before, but you might want to turn to the back of your books to Appendix 6. All the stuff plus a lot more. If you find yourself doesn't a clean, crisp distillation of what that means, this is a great place to start. So I recommend it to you. In part, it also has a definition of the plain meaning rule as the very first entry. However, I suggest to you gently that what we're going to be doing today is exploring textualism, the sort of first step into tightening the grip on the way the text drives interpretive meaning, is played out with two cases. The first one's U.S. versus Locke. The second one is one of the most important cases of environmental law. It's a case that, frankly, I will confess, you want to know, but I actually married an environmental lawyer. We're both environmental lawyers. And Tennessee, I guarantee we would drive out of our way to go by the Tellico Dam, just as a I would like to begin with and with that in mind, I will call on actually Chelsea. I think we missed you, or did I? No?
Yeah, I was dying a slow and painful death.
Oh.
I made a miraculous recovery.
I'm not sure I want to know more.
There's not much more to say.
Okay. No, that's all right. I just was, if you've recovered sufficiently, can you help us with U.S. versus Locke?
I'll do my best.
Oh, actually, before you do, did someone hand back the opt-out sheet? And just making sure you're not on there. My secret fear is I'm always going to call on someone who's already on. But share with us what this case is about.
Sure. So the Locks, they had mining rights for gravel on federal land. Well, Congress passed the Federal Land Policy Management Act, which says that people who have such rights on federal land, they have to submit certain documents prior to December 31st.
Is that the exact words? Okay. All right.
Before December 31st.
Okay. showed up, they submitted the paperwork, the Department of Interior said, too bad, so sad, we know that you've been mining here for years, we don't know how many years, you lose. Because so, what happens?
So, they sue for their mineral
NAACP. He's the one who built the Brown v. Board of Education case. He's taking the law and stretching it to cover new situations. So, I'm sorry, you were saying. Okay, so let me begin with an unfair question. You know, most of my questions are unfair, but that's why they're fun. I'm curious. In reality, so as long as it's not, say, for example, February 30th, clearly an error, as long as it's not something that other now, I'm not trying to put when you actually try and think through, is it just the fact that any deadline, as long as it's clear, is automatically going to be upheld, even if it produces unfair results? Deadlines are just inherently arbitrary. Okay. ambiguity that it doesn't facially have, just trip over. Power to introduce ambiguity. I was just curious. Okay? Now, issues. It's hard to get a stop against the federal government. And interpreting language in a statute, text. Meaning, even if it produces a harsh result. Now you could just say this is just a deadline case, but U.S. versus Locke is one of the first sort of bubbling up of an attempt to move away from legislative intent, statutory intent, and to focus on what the text says, come what may. Let me go to the next. Synopsize the case. Too colorful facts and information for you. Legal in this case. Great. Just to give you an idea, this is not necessarily a beautiful creature. That is a snail darter. It's basically a bait fish, a small minnow-like fish that lives in a very narrow range. There are actually multiple species of darters. they are evolutionarily adapted to pierce the shells of snails, which is their primary diet. And this one just happened to be a genetically distinct, but nonetheless very appearance similar, this appearance very similar to other the Tellico Dam. It is, you can see, not the Hoover Dam. This is a tiny little dam somewhere in the backwoods, Tennessee. It's also notorious. Notorious not because of this case necessarily, but because it also highlighted some interesting dynamics taking place in the Tennessee Valley Authority, which was the Depression era, New Deal era agency created to electrify and bring turbines of another dam downstream. Above it. But also numerous historical events. One university professor in the Sea River. Notice this little dash it by, and being the sort of person he was, he started chasing it down. And he discovered this small little fish and determined it was a separate species. What's going on in this case?
So essentially what you have is
I gotta warn you. Can y'all guys hear in the back? Okay, just make sure you project. Right? Okay, so President Carter's in office, hopping along. people are nodding their heads, no. One? Is it some crazy person muttering living in a trailer park nearby? Like you. This professor was statute. Lawsuits, law students can still file lawsuits. And if you ever tax, but refuse to enjoin the structure, and then the Court of Appeals said, they reverse the district court, but I'm not sure what that means. So they ordered the lower court to enjoin the construction of the dam. Now, why do you think the injunction is important in this case? What do you think is happening as this lawsuit's going through the courts? Sorry? Crazy. They were putting construction crews on overtime in just the space so as a result so to what extent a had the power the federal government and statutory interpretation. So with that in mind now, Londra, and the Chief Justice takes the case and writes the majority opinion. And fish wins. Inch snail darter defeats the federal government and the Tennessee Valley Authority. Let's pause since we're So for those of you who want to be spared me writing that out laboriously on the board, take a look at page 353. And circled the words that you think would drive a broad interpretation of the statute and compel Berger discusses. Terms. Well, the consultation as appropriate. Are you saying that the in other words, does it affect what you actually decide at the end of the day?
It affects what you decide.
Okay. So then let me pause there. Alondra's captured this correctly. If I could just get a little bit of an accent on some of it. Section 7 basically, notice the language in the statute on page 353, it goes to all federal agencies. This is not just EPA. This is not just the Department of Interior. Every agency, including the Department of Defense, including, well, let's say, Department of Homeland Security, all of them have to comply with Section 7 of the Endangered Species Act, which basically says if they're going to take an action, including, in some cases, inaction, including, in some cases, just giving money to someone else to take action, they have to first check a protected species, an endangered species. To find out, they have to consult. And Alondra mentioned the consultation requirement. That means they have to basically touch base with biologists on staff at the Department of Interior, at the Fish and Wildlife Service, and basically get their opinion, it's called a biological opinion, as to whether or not their action would jeopardize the species. This case is all about what happens once they've made that phone call and the biologists have said, yeah, you're endangering this species. What does that mean? What is the biology opinion? What is the Section 7 consultation requirements by really mean? Okay. Went through the consultation process with the Teleco Dam, and the result was?
They told them that it's going to severely impact
them. Severely impact in what way? It is interesting. If you look, the TVA actually does a history of this dam, and it discusses affected the fish died. So is it put 80 feet of water on top of the water that was there, and this fish requires rapids to survive. It's called a darter for a reason. It darts at high speed and preys on the snails. If you flood it and put it under deep water conditions with still, you've basically destroyed their habitat. At the conclusion of the biological opinion was, and I think you're being gentle, this species goes extinct. If they close the dam, according to the fact findings in the district court, this species, except in maybe zoo tanks and freezer storage. So that's the Section 7 consultation requirement on page 353. How does it all come to play then at this point? What did the court decide the TVA must do given that determination, given Section 7? So unless it has a parenthesis, except for snail darters, the language says agencies undergo consultation, and they take action to endanger the species, spent 80% of the money to finish this dam, and even though failure to close it means you've basically taken $100 million to an open field and thrown a match on top of it. Which means for statutory interpretation to issue relief. Okay, so one argument is the language doesn't mean what the ordinary meaning because of subsequent congressional action indicate that continue to be. What is that action? The construction of the dam had been underway when the act was passed, right?
Argument that you can't retroactively. You can't retroactively.
Okay. Anything else? Let me just throw one up, possibility. Does it matter? If it's already largely already done. So is there room in the word action, perhaps? Okay. I'm just make bad sense here. Anyway, talked about what requires them to turn off the steam shovels. Just the plain text of the language, that's it, we're done. And the fact that species are, that's it. So, I'm sorry, which policy?
The policy
of ESA. Well, no, he's talking about a specific tool of statutory interpretation there. And that's what I want to make sure we flesh to light here, because we're all about statutes when you face them. Here the idea is repeal. X passes a statute. Congress X plus 8 years down the road passes a different statute. That it is disfavored to read statutes in a way they implication is disfavored, and you have to go with the other one. That implicit appropriations legislation. Why would that be the case? What is it about appropriations that makes it particular? Okay, what else can appropriations legislation cover? Thing that involves money. Remember, the Senate rules specifically prohibit substantive legislation through appropriations legislation. That's why appropriations legislation is cash. It doesn't appropriations legislation. At least in theory, that's the way it's supposed to work. It's honored in the breach this time, many times, but nonetheless, that means that this appropriations legislation specifically was not supposed to do things substantively, which means you especially shouldn't be looking to it to repeal the Endangered Species Act. That. To the repeal by implication doctrine. Okay? So, I mean, this was Justice Powell makes the point that there might be some ambiguity to say that it shouldn't apply to acts that were already underway, but retroactivity typically means you can't pass legislation that imposes legal consequence in actions that predate the legislation. Notice here, is this retroactive to simply say, we're not so retroactivity, but notice again, typically is that statutes do not apply retroactively unless Congress specifically says so. All right? And that same, they're closing the doors of the dam. They're flooding the land. That is specifically an action. So again, notice though, this is all text. So let me ask Alondra one other question. Why does Justice Berger even bother quoting legislative history? What does it add? Okay, so I get that there's rhetorical force. I get that that argument makes sense if we're going to talk about remedies, which we'll circle back to in a second. But if you were to cut all the legislative history discussion out, does that hurt or help the statutory language analysis? Does it really add anything? And I think that's and here's why the legislative history thinks we're right. And I can tell you after a certain point, you just start running a red through section B. It rarely added anything substantively to the court's conclusion. It essentially backfilled them the way exam. But I want to part of the analysis here, which is, injunction makes sense. Can the court issue an injunction? And that was the fight that the here talks briefly about. There was an interpretation that the district court, and this is what the circuit court said, had no choice. They had to enjoin the federal government. The court was ordered by Congress to exercise its equitable powers to stop the Tennessee Valley Authority from proceeding forward. This relief. I will simply suggest to you that is still a huge issue. Right now, some of the most important legislation is enjoined before it even gets implemented. Those of you who are familiar with certain aspects to a chance to see light of day. That power is still a major issue. We'll come back to later semester. I just want to but it's not the main holding of today's case that we care, which is using textualism to give a straightforward, clear, hard interpretation of language without necessarily resorting to legislation. This is happened this major direction. Rightly decided. I'm okay. You're willing to burn $100 million to protect bait fish. Sorry? So if it was just about the snail darter and wasn't limited to this case because it started before the act was passed, would you be okay with the outcome? And now,
would I be okay with like cleaning the dam, or would I be okay with like
wasting the $100 million? Turning it into a the public art. Okay, all right, fair enough. It's a rounding error. I mean, we did shut down the federal government over $5 billion, but okay, Alex?
So I heard a buyer, but I really don't like the TVA. So.
Really? Why is that?
Just seem crooked to me.
Have you had experience with them before?
I've read a few things about them. They come across as great.
Well, they're the largest power producer in the federal government. They're the largest strip miner in the federal government. They were the largest polluter in the federal government, even more than the Department of Defense, because they ran all the coal-fired power plants in the Tennessee Valley. Yeah, I can see that, but I'm not sure that a court would be persuaded by the fact you don't like the TVA. All right? So I'm just mentioning this because the outcome of this case went down sideways the throats of most folks in Congress. And there's, if you go back, when Justice Marshall died, one of the things he did not do that most Supreme Court justices do is he gave his papers to the Library of Congress without a 50-year hold. Normally, they put them under lock and key until everyone's dead. Justice Marshall just put them out there. So the first thing all of us environmental lawyers did was we ran down to Congress to see what he was thinking, ran to the Library of Congress to see what he was thinking. It turns out that there's information that makes it pretty clear that Justice Berger wrote this opinion to basically provoke Congress. He thought it was such a ridiculous outcome, and you can tell from the tone of his language a little bit, that he wanted to dare them to change the act by giving this result, which he thought was facially absurd. Not anticipated that over time it's actually been viewed as sort of a hallmark of what the Endangered Act should be. So two things happened. They did amend the Endangered Species Act. They introduced the concept, this is obscure, but it's fun to talk about, the God Squad. It is a high-level committee of the heads of other federal agencies that gets together, and when someone wants to basically extinguish a species, you can get their permission. The act lets you do it. They invoked it for the spotted owl. They invoked it for some other species. How many times do you think the God Squad has allowed the extinction of a species after Congress created this whole process? Right? Is that five or?
Five or at least a couple?
Okay. I'm curious, is that because that's your sort of opinion of what Congress would do? Or sorry, that the administrative agencies would do?
Yeah, I just kind of think that at some point, money and rules of animals.
Okay. We probably
not
need.
It, no. I should rephrase. Not that it should.
But that it does.
My opinion would be the opposite.
It's a descriptive, not an ethical statement.
Right.
Okay. At some point, we need to open the bottle of Blanton's and start to have a talk about this.
Anytime you're ready.
Okay.
You gotta buy it, though.
I'll just simply say my budget can't handle some varieties. I looked it up. That's pretty shocking. Some of these are not even sold to the United States. I'd have to fly over to Europe to get some of them. I'm not going to. Zero. The God Squad has never approved the extinction of a species. So it gives an interesting insight as to the interpretation of the language here in Congress creating this, that how many times it actually makes economic or legal sense to eradicate a species to benefit a particular federal action. Now, there are exemptions for Department of Defense activities now, and there are exemptions from the Endangered Species Act for things like building the border wall, but nonetheless, the act is still very strongly adhered to. The second thing Congress did all comes down to a fellow named Howard Baker. Howard Baker was the Mitch McConnell of his time. He is a Republican majority leader in the Senate. And I'll give you one guess as to which state he hails from. Tennessee, absolutely. In the middle of the night, on the last day of the session, a large bill was passed which had a rider inserted at the last minute which specifically authorized finishing the dam and closing the gates. I won't suggest there was any coordination, but apparently the construction crews were standing by with night lights, ready to go to work the instant the bill was signed. So the dam was done, the doors were closed, and one last sort of denouement I can't resist mentioning. What do you think happened to the fish? How do you know? You looked it up! Damn, I hate it when people steal my punchline. You're actually right. It turned out they discovered relict populations, small pockets in other branches of the river. And now they've actually started a recovery program, and the fish is no longer endangered. It's been promoted up to threatened. So in a way, you could say, all's well that ends well. It does sort of have raise some concerns about the process that got us there and the fact that we now have the dam, which maybe still is a little bit questionable in terms of how, you know, the process might be questioned. So any questions so far about any of all this? Yes, Byron.
So do these rules apply like on Native American reservations as well?
Okay. I'm sorry, go ahead. Now, it's an interesting question. It applies to the federal government. So remember, Section 7 only applies to federal agencies. So the question then becomes, if a tribal authority wants to do something, and it's a federally recognized tribe, is the federal government essentially condoning the action of the tribal authority? Right. If they need a permit, absolutely, that decision is covered by that. But it's... there's some interesting questions. There's actually other federal statutes that protect expressions of religious or cultural activity by Native American tribes. And how those interact with the Endangered Species Act is actually a big area of litigation right now. So if it's an area you're interested in, let me know. I can carpet bomb you with paper. All right, any other questions or thoughts? Okay, then let me just make a few final points. Number one, notice the opinion and the discussion afterwards makes a distinction between plain meaning and ordinary meaning. Now, we've kind of touched that a little bit, but it's an important distinction. Ordinary meaning is the Jimmy Kimmel stopping people on the street to ask them questions about current events interpretation of language. What would the person on the street say, presented with the language, without separate individual, separate context? Now that is not plain meaning. plain meaning can be hyper-technical and specialized. It could be true as false and free as slave. It depends on what the statute defines the term to be. And if the language of the statute is clear and plain on its face, it may not be an ordinary meaning, but it's still plain. It's facially apparent. Does that make sense for everybody? The other thing is that plain meaning can include, even under a textual interpretation, this sort of soft textualism, it can include legislative history, but of a special kind. It's called statutory history. Statutory history is not committee report statements. It is not debates on the floor. It's not colloquia between two senators standing behind podiums. It's the actual progress of the statute through the process, of the legislative process, and you can see where the language changes. Again, you're looking at language, but you're looking at the language's evolution and inferring the meaning of the words based on the way it changed and the way the structure of the statute modifies. So when you talk about legislative history, make sure that there are certain varieties of it that are just fine, even to the hardest, most ardent textualist, as long as it's statutory legislative history. Okay? Any questions about that? Yes? I'm sorry?
That also includes prior related legislation. We're talking about acts before this act and how they differ, so they still compare.
Exactly right. So remember, the prior version of the Endangered Species Act essentially included discretionary authority to the agencies to do it if it was appropriate. Congress removed that language, and it's that legislative statutory history that infers the intent we're talking about. Okay. All right. Anything else? Because I'm dangerously close to doing something radical that I rarely, if ever, do. If we have plumbed the depths of this case, and I have shared my passion for environmental law for you sufficiently already today, I'm going to actually end class a little bit early. Unless... No? Yes? Talk about next classes if you'd like. Okay. Well, be prepared. Our next class, we're going to go deeper into textualism. And in particular, we'll start reading Justice Scalia's opinions, which are at the forefront of developing this theory. And these cases will talk about that item that is so close and dear to the hearts of us all, recovering attorney's fees. So with that in mind, have a great day. I will see everyone on Wednesday.
Semester, but it seems to me like the plain meaning rule will cover like 99% of everything.
Kind of, sort of. I'd say the number, just one second.